Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, March 22nd was World Water Day, meant to call attention to the crisis in world water supply and sanitation that makes lack of access to clean water far and away the leading cause of death for children under five. Headlines about taking shorter showers suggest mainstream media didn't dive that deeply into the crisis's environmental, economic, or political context. We'll talk about water with Darcy O'Callaghan, International Policy Director at Food and Water Watch. Also on the show, you may have heard that the class of 2014 is the most indebted ever, or that, though it varies from state to state, graduates leave school with an average of $33,000 of debt. But now some are telling us that the student loan crisis is easing, others that it was never that big a deal to begin with. Well, what's up with that, and what impact would Barack Obama's proposed student aid Bill of Rights have on the issue? We'll get that story from Natalia Abrams, Executive Director of StudentDebtCrisis.org. That's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a quick look back at the week's press. Senator Ted Cruz declared he's running for the Republican presidential nomination, giving corporate media a chance to recycle some conventional wisdom. When Democratic candidates lose, elite media say it's because they ran too far to the left. The corollary truism is that when Republicans lose, it's because they were too centrist. Here's USA Today, March 22nd, talking about Cruz. Quote, he repeatedly criticizes the mushy middle, as reflected by the GOP's last two presidential nominees, Mitt Romney and Senator John McCain, and denounces his fellow Republicans for failing to make bold distinctions with Democrats. Close quote. CBS's Jake Miller the next day said, quote, pointing to losses by 2008 nominee Senator John McCain and 2012 nominee Mitt Romney, Cruz has urged the GOP to nominate a strong conservative or risk defeat for the third consecutive time, close quote. And the same day, The Washington Post's Dan Balz explained Cruz, quote, has argued that the party failed to win the White House not because it has become too conservative, but because Republicans have nominated politicians who were not conservative enough, who could not carry the message of today's conservatism with energy, optimism, and authenticity. Frustrated by the campaigns of Mitt Romney in 2012 and John McCain in 2008, many conservatives agree, close quote. None of these stories challenge this idea that McCain and Romney lost because they were not conservative enough. But despite media's insistence on John McCain's maverick status, his voting record places him as among the most conservative senators in Congress. Romney's reputation as a moderate was largely based on his having implemented, as governor of Massachusetts, a health care program inspired by the Heritage Foundation. Both McCain and Romney ran as conservatives with conservative platforms, and they lost. By accepting Cruz's characterization of them as moderates who lost because of their moderation, corporate media endorse his argument that the Republican Party's path to success involves even more of a right turn. 60 Minutes has done it again. By it, we mean run a segment about Africa in which actual Africans feature little or not at all. Last fall, complaints were raised, including by us, about a segment the CBS News magazine did on the Ebola virus, in which correspondent Lara Logan went all the way to Liberia and then failed to talk to any Liberians. The segment focused on a single clinic at which viewers were told most of the workers were Liberian. But Logan spoke only to the Americans there, though Liberians did sometimes appear in the background, at one point singing hymns. Former New York Times correspondent Howard French wasn't having it. He described it as part of a broader Africa without Africans problem, the erasure of Africans from history, in this case their own history, which reserves meaningful thought and agency for whites. And here it was again on March 15th when 60 Minutes ran a segment about British multimillionaire casino owner Damien Aspinall, who has a dream of sending zoo-born gorillas to Africa for release. The piece followed Aspinall to Gabon, but as Howard French told Journalism's Richard Prince, it showed no one who actually lived there. They were mentioned. At one point, Aspinall tells 60 Minutes' Leslie Stahl that the Gabonese cut off Gorilla's hands to sell his ashtrays. French wrote a letter to the show's producers, signed by more than 150 other journalists, that noted that this sort of coverage, in which Westerners are the central characters and Africans are limited to roles as passive victims, or occasionally brutal or corrupt villains and incompetents, not only disserves Africa, it also badly disserves the news-viewing and news-reading public. And the letter asked them to rethink their approach. A spokesman for 60 Minutes told Journalism's they're proud of their work and that they've reached out to Howard French in hopes of talking with him. He says he hasn't actually heard from them. Finally, Danny Schechter, groundbreaking media critic and producer for both corporate and alternative media, died on March 19th at the age of 72. Danny got his start on Boston's progressive rock station WBCN as Danny Schechter, your news dissector. As John Nichols recalled in The Nation, he reported to listeners what was happening, then he explained why it was happening, and then he revealed why other media outlets did not tell the whole story. Well, remarkably, Danny went from critiquing corporate media to making it, becoming an Emmy-winning producer at ABC's 2020, and later helping to launch CNN. Jeff Cohen, the founder of FAIR, the group that produces this show, notes that Danny was virtually our only major media ally, encouraging us to spotlight the constraints of corporate media, even as he faulted reporters themselves for not fighting harder. Schechter eventually moved on, launching the production company Global Vision, which listeners may remember for the milestone show South Africa Now, that chronicled the rise and triumph of the anti-apartheid movement. That show upset right-wingers. David Horowitz bragged to the Los Angeles Times about getting it canceled by station KCET, before popular pressure, including by FAIR, got it back on the air. KCET itself complained the show was imbalanced. Not enough racists and advocates of apartheid were featured. Well, Danny explained in a piece for FAIR how a fall-off in coverage of South Africa led public pressure for divestments and sanctions to subside, as, quote, dwindling news attention resulted in the perception that matters were no longer in a crisis stage demanding action. Close quote. An outsider who got to the inside and came back out again, Danny Schechter never forgot that news is not just another format, it's the lifeblood of democracy. He'll be missed. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. Almost half of the world's available water is transboundary, meaning it's in the rivers, lakes, or groundwater systems of two or more countries. That could make water a model for how we can learn to manage a resource that none of us can live without, or it could lead to disaster. Already, a majority of the world's people live within 30 miles of water sources that are running out or impaired. Giving water its proper social, environmental, and economic value is one of the purposes of last week's World Water Day. But reporters shouldn't really need a news peg. With California drying up and Detroit cutting off the tap to the city's poor, water is very much a front-page story. Here to help us understand what's happening is Darcy O'Callaghan, International Policy Director at Food and Water Watch. She joins us by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Counterspin, Darcy O'Callaghan.
Hi, Janine. Thanks for having me.
Well, this piece that I saw on NPR's website, Take a Shorter Shower, It's World Water Day, mentioned that it takes a lot of water to produce a pound of meat, for example. But the emphasis was on all of us as individuals finding ways to cut down on our water usage, irrespective of politics, as it was put. I'm making a little fun of this piece, but I wonder, what's your general response to a media approach to the water crisis that says, leave politics out of it and just use less as an individual?
Well, I'm really glad you're putting a spotlight on that issue because, you know, frankly, it's pretty frustrating to an organization like ours that tries to educate people that you can't shop your way out of climate change, just like you can't take a shorter shower to move out of the freshwater crisis. We know that droughts are almost always reported as a result of climate change, for example, but more often they're a result of poor water stewardship. I'm talking about things like overextracting groundwater, growing water-intensive crops in water-stressed regions, allowing toxic runoff from industrial agriculture to pollute our waterways. You know, we've got the technology and the know-how to solve this problem, but we don't have the collective political will, and that's really the problem that we need to deal with.
One of the responses that we have seen that there does seem to be a will for is privatization of water. What do you think of that?
One of the big issues that I always try to highlight is that higher water pricing isn't the answer to the global water crisis. There are many corporations around the world that would like to privatize water and make a profit off of it. And there are a lot of folks that have bought into this argument. The reality is that simply pricing water higher under the idea that people will then value it more is not correct. And in fact, it's a red herring about the truth of the problem. For example, household consumption, both in the U.S. and globally, is only about 8% of freshwater consumption, whereas agriculture, for irrigation largely, and industrial use makes up the rest of it. So, you know, 92% is agriculture and industry, things that we can have a much easier impact on than household use. And in the U.S., that's an even more interesting statistic in that 52% of fresh water is for industrial, commercial, mining, and energy use. We're talking about things like increasing water being used for some of the misguided energy policies like hydraulic fracturing that uses massive amounts of fresh water. These are things that we can put a stop to immediately that not only address the fresh water crisis, but also address the climate change crisis. You mentioned the California situation, and in many parts of California, they are growing water-thirsty crops like almonds for export. And we know that the more you can grow climate-appropriate crops for a region and for regional consumption, the better the results are, not only for water consumption, but also for the broader climate change issues. I mean, there are so many examples of poor water management that could really use more highlighting. The Aral Sea in Uzbekistan has often been referred to as one of the greatest man-made environmental crises in the world. At one point, the Aral Sea was the fourth largest water body in the world, and it has now shrunk to less than 10% of its original size. And the reason is because back in the 60s and 70s, the former Soviet government had initiated a program for irrigating cotton fields for export. They had misdirected many of the rivers from replenishing the Aral Sea towards irrigating the cotton fields. And still to this day, cotton is the number one export crop and the number one product for Uzbekistan, and they've had a really hard time getting away from that crop and diversifying their economy. And so what you see in that region is that not only does the Aral Sea no longer support aquatic life, but there are massive salt and chemical storms that blow across the region. It's been a huge impact not only on people's health in terms of increased cancer rates, increased rates of miscarriage, but you've also seen impacts on climate in general. And so whereas once they had a fairly moderate climate in the region, now because they're missing that large body of water, you've got really cold winters and really hot summers. And so on one hand, water feels the impacts of climate change, but water policy also leads to greater climate change. It goes both ways.
So much reason to take this issue up from the level of the individual and individual use and really talk about broader policies, not just nationally, but internationally. I know that you have worked on some alternative forums for water. What do you make of the global response so far? What does it look like compared to what you think we need to be doing?
Well, the reaction is not nearly enough, and part of the challenge is that all water is local. So you know, unless your home community is feeling water stress, it's hard to really relate to the issue. But as soon as you feel that issue locally, it becomes massive. You know, it really mobilizes people once their community has water stress. So what we need to see is greater mobilization and greater education of the broader public that these are issues we can be addressing now. And I think one of the bright lights is that we're seeing a greater convergence among two sectors that have not typically been communicating with each other. And what I'm referring to are the folks that are human rights advocates who are focused on water access issues. And then on the other hand, you've got environmentalists who are focused on watershed protection. And these two issues really can't be separated, because without a sustainable watershed, there is no water for people. And so the good news is that those two separate areas are really starting to be linked, and I think that's really important.
Well, let me bring you back again for another sort of less bright aspect of this, because I've heard it raised as a fear that some of the things that we might be pursuing are not being pursued because of people viewing water as a commodity boom. Do you think we really should be concerned about, I've heard them called, water barons?
Oh, it's a huge problem. We actually have investment banks that own water systems in the U.S. and in other places around the world. And we believe that water is a human right, a part of the global commons, and it's a public good that absolutely ought to be publicly managed. There's really no room for profiting from the most basic human need. So we're running campaigns across the U.S. and partnering with allies around the world, trying to prevent privatization of municipal water systems. And it's tough because a lot of municipalities, they're underfunded. It's hard to develop the political will to fund infrastructure at the necessarily needed levels. But this has got to be what the public is fighting for, because we've seen across the board that privatizations lead to higher rates for the water users and for less accountability. And so it's really essential that we see public water management be the only option for water.
It seems there's a disconnect between agencies and entities saying water is a human right, and at the same time, there being private entities that seem to suggest that it's something else. The human right view has to win out here.
Absolutely. And the root of the problem is the same as with so many other problems, which is that there's too much money in politics. And so there have been a lot of private corporations that have money on the line and money to win by influencing policy. And so it takes a lot of effort. But the reality is that we actually provide water publicly in the vast majority of communities around the world. And when privatizations are proposed, people really do get up in arms and they mobilize, and they've primarily done the important job of protecting water as a public good.
All right, then. We'll consider this part of that effort. We've been speaking with Darcy O'Callaghan from Food and Water Watch. You can find their work online at foodandwaterwatch.org. Darcy O'Callaghan, thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks so much for having me.
Four-year college tuition rose more than 100% between 1990 and 2010 as state funding dwindled. At the same time, family income flatlined, making student loans for many the only way to achieve the goal of a college degree. That's partly how we arrived at a situation wherein many students graduate owing tens of thousands of dollars, sometimes more than they were even aware of, and are unable to do much besides watch that debt balloon before their eyes. What are some of the other factors driving the phenomenon that's harmful not just to individuals, but to the economy as a whole? Joining us now to discuss the issue is Natalia Abrams, Executive Director of StudentDebtCrisis.org. Welcome to Counterspin, Natalia Abrams.
Thank you so much for having me, Janine.
The crisis in student debt doesn't then just stem from an economy that makes it hard for graduates to find work that pays enough to pay off the loans. There are some factors, aren't there, that are special to the student loan industry that contribute to the problem?
Absolutely. We often say that student debt is this negatively affected class of loans that you can receive. It's quite different than a car loan or a home loan. One of the basic points is that there's no real out. There's no bankruptcy for student loan debt, both for private loans and for federal loans. The interest rate is much higher than what banks are borrowing at currently or what even you could get for a new home loan. The average student loan interest rate for federal loans is around 4%. For graduate students, it's around 7%. And that's federal loans. Private loans go all the way up to 10, 13%. And right now you can't even refinance for most student loans the way you could for a home and maybe even a car. So those are the areas where student loan debt acts quite differently than other types of consumer loans that we have.
It seems that there are some fairly standard consumer protections that are not in play here. Would you say that there are, in fact, incentives to predation in the industry?
Absolutely. I absolutely think, especially when it comes to private student loans, this is a predatory industry. We do not teach financial literacy broadly in this country, yet we expect 18-year-olds to know better when they sign on the dotted line than, say, a 50-year-old businessman that could start a business and then claim bankruptcy and restart again. That focus of not training people but then giving them hundreds of thousands of dollars, I think that in itself is predatory for sure.
And then there are those collection powers that Senator Elizabeth Warren says would make mobsters envious.
Even the Department of Education, as Senator Warren actually said, profit $150 billion off the backs of students. I don't understand when a student can't borrow at what the banks borrow or a little over what students are paying, 4 to 10%, and homeowners are paying 3 to 6%. I don't think that sends the right message. We need a highly educated population. And unfortunately, due to the high cost of college, it's very important that student loans are available, but at a low cost. Ultimately, our organization believes that we need to start going down the road of free higher education and eventually loan forgiveness. But we are willing to work with legislators like Senator Warren, or recently we've been working with Representative Scott Peters in San Diego, who are looking at common sense solutions that we can act right now. But the long-term game is to fundamentally change the way we pay for higher education in our country. We've seen some good ideas come out of the Democratic Party, and not to make this partisan, but it's becoming so. They've had over a year since Senator Warren first introduced student loan refinancing. And we've seen the Republican budget just come out in the past few weeks. Not only are they not for something like refinancing, which is very sensible, they want to get rid of public service loan forgiveness. They want to get rid of pay-as-you-earn, which is an income-based repayment program. And they want to cut the Pell Grant by $150 billion. So they've had a year to come up with a solution, and all they want to do is make it even harder for people to go to school and finance their education.
Well, Barack Obama has proposed this student aid bill of rights. What would that do, and what would it not do?
So it's a framework. It's a step in the right direction. And actually, we've already seen legislators like Senator Warren or Representative Peters come out with new bills in response to the student aid bill of rights. So what it's saying is that we need basic consumer protections for borrowers. Borrowers need to be able to have a central agency where they can go and complain about these lenders and collection agencies. But, you know, it doesn't go far enough reforming the system as much as it needs to. We've actually circulated a petition. Almost 60,000 of our members have signed in support of just the narrative of calling it rights for borrowers. I think that helps us move into the concept that education itself is a right for all students and for all people in this country.
Well, let me just ask you, what do you say to those who say, okay, maybe they didn't read the fine print, but still a loan is a loan, and the solution to student debt is just for them to pay it back or to face the consequences? How do you elevate this above the individual?
First of all, I always go back to consumer protections that, you know, if you feel that way, these loans should be treated just like any other loans, and in fact, they're not. But then in a bigger picture, we need to take care of each other. We are a safer society. The more we're educated, the less we're in debt. There's 40 million borrowers, but really if you look at the borrowers' families, their children, their grandparents, this almost affects 200 million people in our country, which is two-thirds of our overall population.
And certainly the some of the background issues that are attendant, like the rising tuitions, like the dwindling state support for colleges, those are broad phenomena that affect everyone.
We've seen state disinvestment really take hold since the Great Recession of 2008 and 2009. And the states pay less per student than they ever had before, again, putting the cost on the backs of students who can afford it the least.
What kind of questions would you like to see journalists exploring as they cover this issue? Because the latest turn in media coverage looks to me like a little series of stories saying, oh, remember that student debt crisis we were worried about? It turns out it's not such a big problem after all. What would you like to see media doing on this issue?
I think that we need to call the crisis a crisis. We are student debt crisis for a reason. $1.3 trillion in debt. We've added $100 billion in just the last calendar year. So this isn't going away. There's projections that it will be near $2 trillion, but I think it's 2020. So we're not that far away. If we don't do something now, it is just going to blow up. So we need to see journalists looking at the human face of the crisis. We have a bunch of testimonials on our website because we believe it's really important to hear from the borrowers themselves. These are not people that are trying to necessarily escape from their debt. They understand what they got into, but they just want a fair way to repay it. But then I do think we need to move a step further and start looking and exploring options of debt forgiveness, of free college, which there's some organizations, Jobs with Justice, that have stated, and I believe Think Progress, the blog as well, that we pay as much for our financial aid system for the bureaucracy of that as we do to send everyone to public higher education for free. So I think we need to start exploring big concept ideas on how we're going to rectify this crisis. And the downplay of the crisis to me is just disrespectful to the 40 million borrowers that are struggling every day to make their payments.
We've been speaking with Natalia Abrams of studentdebtcrisis.org. Natalia Abrams, thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you so much.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on FAIR's website. It's fair.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thank you for listening to Counterspin.